Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. 12 years with Hitler, secretary to the Führer. In 1930, as a young woman, Christa Schröder, I think that's what I'm trying to pronounce, the stenographer for the Nazi Party, before being hired in 33 as private secretary to Adolf Hitler. It is the subject of a fascinating new book called 12 Years with Hitler. Here to speak about it is Roger Morehouse. Roger, good morning to you. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Just explain a little bit about your background before we come on to this fascinating story.
I'm a historian. I've specialised in the Third Reich for, well, many years. I've been doing this for probably about 25 years, if not more. 8 books. I've sort of strayed into a bit of Polish history, but my main concern has always been the Third Reich. I've always found it fascinating. It's just that, I suppose to a large extent, how everything went so spectacularly wrong in what was, one of the sort of powerhouses of European civilization. That's one of the sort of primary aspects that interests me, and the mechanics of it. I mean, the sheer mechanics of how the Third Reich functioned is really interesting, and very often not what we think.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that we spend because as the listeners will be groaning into their wallets is because I'm that worst sort of creature, an armchair historian. I think the Reich is fascinating, but not as a purient sort of thing, as a case study, as a warning. And it's interesting that we study this thing, and actually we've been studying it for longer than the thousand year Reich actually existed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the sort of the historical resonance of it is still astonishing. And it is the main point of reference, I think, for a lot of certainly European current commentary on whatever it is. A lot of our points of reference still go back to the Third Reich, go back to that 12-year period. So its sort of cultural and political resonance is still absolutely huge, and is showing no signs of abating.
What I find interesting, though, as well in the book that you've been working on, is the fact that everybody knows the heavy hitters, if you like. You've got Bormann, you've got Goebbels, of course, who's being brought in. You've got Hitler, obviously. Himmler, Heydrich, etc. But this one deals with, if you like, because one of the things that makes the Reich so terrifying is the ordinary people who work and just seem to get on with it without any sort of questioning why. And that's a disturbing thing. And is this perhaps the case of being Hitler's private secretary?
Yeah, I think there's a degree of that. I mean, she is, sounds horrible to say it, but she is very ordinary, Christa Schröder. Quite an ordinary sort of lower middle class background. She actually replies to a small ad in 1930 and ends up as a typist in the SA headquarters, the Sturmabteilung headquarters, which, of course, as you will know, Giles, is the brown shirts, Hitler's brown shirts. And she then, by chance, ends up as she's called in. Hitler wants to do a late night dictation. He did a lot of stuff late night. That was very much his modus operandi. And she was brought in because his regular typist was unavailable. She was, they sort of cast around her any of the typists available, and she got the gig. And then after that, she was with him essentially. She was one of a number of typists or secretaries, but she was with him essentially for the next 12 years between 33 and 45. There is, one of the most famous, I suppose, is Traudl Junger, who also wrote a memoir. She lived a bit longer than Schröder, so in a sense, and she came to prominence. It's basically, if you watch the film Downfall, that's kind of written almost from Traudl Junger's perspective, and they used her memoir quite extensively in preparing that film. But Christa Schröder was a little bit older. She actually was with Hitler for longer than Traudl Junger was. And her original, she wrote, so they're effectively two memoirs. It's quite a curious story with the book. So just to clarify, I wrote the introduction to this. Yeah. The words are hers and or this French army officer called Albert Soller. And there was a sort of controversy around the book, because when the book originally came out in particularly in German and in French after the war. You know, she kind of cried foul at Sulla, and she said, well, you know, some of this stuff is not stuff that I said to you. And he'd been interviewing other people, and he'd sort of compiled together this thing. So it's originally published under his name, and then she wrote her own, or she gave her papers to another historian in the 80s after her death to have her own story written. So this is, I think the estimate is it's about 70% her material from when he was interviewing her after the war. But it is that thing that you say, it's kind of the ordinary person's view in a way. I'm not saying that she was unintelligent at all, but, you know, this is her view of what life was like in that entourage, in that sort of closest entourage with Hitler over that 12 years. It's, you know, her take on some of the sort of those personalities, like you mentioned, the Ribbentrops and the Hesses and the and Martin Bormann and so on. It's her sort of pen portraits of those people, which is fascinating, actually.
Yeah.
To actually have someone that was there and saw them close up and not necessarily kind of starstruck, but, you know, perhaps initially a little bit admiring of them, that here was this sort of grand politician. But then, you know, after a few years or even a few months, that would wear off and you'd get the reality. And she's very brutal about them. Like, she talked about Eva Braun, for example. She talked about her, referred to her as a dull little courtesan, which is like, I mean, she was not above the catty comic.
Yeah, but you see, Hitler's got, here's a spoiler alert. Hitler's got a really interesting relationship with women after his first girlfriend is found dead on the floor with a gunshot wound. And we're never really sure who, what, where. It's suicidal. But from there, his relationship with women, Goebbels' wife, for example, is fascinating. And also, you know, it's that whole Nazi thing of womanhood. So you're doing the secretary job. Ava's got to be there, but you kind of think he's got more time for his German Shepherd than he has for her. And also, it must have been, presumably, there must be a rota of prosecutors, because Hitler's speeches would be these monologues in private. People used to dread going to them not so much Wolf's Lair because it's mosquito covered and damp. But if you're in the middle of a Polish forest, for goodness sake, if you're up on Eagle's Lair, you know, the wonderful sitting with, you know, the mountains all around you, and he decides at like 5 in the afternoon to go into one of his monologues, you're going to be there until next Thursday.
Yes, it's very true. And it's something a lot of those in the entourage would kind of, you know, increasingly sort of roll their eyes at, was Hitler's monologues. And he didn't like to be interrupted. He hated to be contradicted. I mean, there's a moment where she, Christa Schroeder, where she falls out with him, I think it's in 1944, and it's because she publicly contradicted him. So he said something in one of these sort of round, you know, they're all sitting around a table sort of having lunch, and he would give forth about whatever it was. And it wasn't always high politics, you know, it could be one of his favourite subjects, you know, for example, stuff like dog breeding. I mean, you know, so, you know, he's got to give forth with this stuff. And there was a moment that she talks about in the book where she contradicts him, and he just cuts her dead. And then subsequently, you know, she was sort of not invited, spectacular, you know, very obviously not invited to, you know, the next lunch or the lunch after that. He's just, you know, sends her to Coventry. So he really could not tolerate being contradicted, especially, I think, by a woman. So you're right, on the one hand, you know, Nazi Germany is peculiar in that sense because it has a very particular view of what a woman should be. Right, they had this line that they used to give, or this slogan, Kirche, Küche, and Kirche, Küche. What's the last one?
Kinder?
I've forgotten it now.
It's not, wasn't Kinder.
Kinder, yes.
Kinder, yeah.
So children, church, and kitchen.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely rigid view. This is the conservative view of what women should be in the Third Reich. And yet, because they're sending all the men to the front and they're importing vast numbers of forced labourers, you have this mass, you know, unprecedented call up of women into industry and into the workplace. So, you know, contradictory in practice, even though they had this image. But Hitler was very conservative. You know, he viewed Eva Braun really as little more than a kind of an adornment to him. He didn't want her to say anything. He didn't want her opinion. He just wanted to have this beautiful woman on his arm. You know, so he's very, very conservative in that respect. But he was kind of respectful to women. There's a weird thing that comes across very strongly in this, is how, you know, in private and particularly with his secretaries, you know, he had these sort of Viennese manners. You know, he was a hand kisser. You know, he was very polite to them. He used to I mean, it's quite telling. He used to call his group of secretaries, he used to call them my children.
Ooh.
To their faces, you know, come my children. You know,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, you can read a lot into that.
Yeah.
But she always says he's absolutely correct. He's absolutely, you know, very polite. He kisses hands. He talks, he refers to them as, you know, Fraulein Schröder, for example, Miss Schröder. You know, very, very, very correct and polite. So it's a very peculiar and particular view that she has, you know, from the inside of that entourage.
You mentioned that there's more women. There are more women in positions because the men are fighting, you know, some hellhole on sort of East, you know, East Prussia, Königsberg, etc. But this then brings the question, because they're working in factories. You mentioned slave labor coming in. You know where this is going, Roger. And so therefore, there's a mass. And when this finishes, and you know we know how it finishes, there's a mass sort of not amnesia, but there's a mass abdication of responsibility, because it was always you know, we were only obeying orders. I mean, how Speer gets away, I have no idea. But if you are a woman working in the factories or working in a position of factories and you are checking the trams coming in, you know that people are being transported for slave labor. You know the conditions they are working in. And that's before we get to the you know, to the Holocaust and like 43, 44. Is there any in her writing? Presumably, there is no talk about one essay conference and what will then happen with the quote unquote, you know, we need to do something about the Jews, quote unquote. Mm.
Yeah, no, there isn't. It's one of those sort of big gaps in this, and I think this is one of those things. A lot of people have been very critical of Christa Schröder for that, you know, saying it's sort of self exculpatory in a way. You know, she's trying to whitewash her own history. She's trying to say that she was a victim. She wasn't necessarily a, you know, complicit in any of that stuff. I'm slightly more nuanced. I mean, we can't know exactly what she knew, but I think you're right. You know, there's a number of elements here that we have to consider, right? The first one is, I think, the degree of knowledge generally. And now you're right to say that ordinary people, you know, there's a sort of a rumor mill. There's, you know, if you have your eyes open, you know, there's a rumor mill, and it would have been possible. And this is what Trudel Junger says in one of her videoed interviews. She says, you know, we should have known. That's the phrase she uses. Mm. We should have known. If we'd had our eyes open, if we'd asked the right questions, if we'd been sort of critical enough or critically minded enough, we should have known. But the point is that she didn't. You know, but even those, you know, there's various other elements here. There's a wonderful memoir by a member of the Berlin resistance, right? It's called Der Schattenmann, the Shadow Man.
Mm.
And she says at the end of that, in that particular memoir, she says, you know, she was hiding Jews, you know, in Berlin during the war. But she says at the end, you know, we were realistic about what was going on. We were even pessimistic. And then she says, but Auschwitz? Like, it was so beyond what was even remotely, you know, comprehensible to them.
And
I think we have to, you know, we know that we know what happened with absolute 2020 hindsight. They didn't. And I think, you know, when you come to look at Christa Schröder, there are two factors just want to mention. First one is access to information. You know, now I think we tend to project back a bit. We've got, you know, a million sources of information, too much information these days. There's too many sources. That back then, you go back, you know, there was the official route of information, and that was kind of it.
Yeah.
Right? There was still the rumor mill, as I said, but again, you had to be sort of, you had to have a decent source and you had to have the understanding to take it on board, which is another question. But then in her case as well, I use the analogy of, you know, we assume that because she's Hitler's secretary, she must be seeing documents saying, you know, headed, what we're going to do about the Jews.
Yeah.
That didn't happen, right? It just didn't happen. Hitler says at the beginning of the war, you know, he puts an order out where he says all sensitive discussions of sensitive subjects are going to be done. But done verbally, you know, we're not going to commit them to paper. So yes, okay, she's part of that bureaucratic machine. But I think the analogy I always give here is the eye of the storm is not the best place to view the storm.
Yeah.
So actually, she's doing, you know, very work a day, kind of writing out speeches and so on. But she, as she says, she never saw evidence of the Holocaust.
And if you are in Germany at this time, let's just, I mean, I'm not in no way am I apologizing for it, but this is happening in East Prussia. This is Poland area, or it's happening in Silesia, Frank's area, Hans Frank's area, which is now Ukraine.
The general government.
The general government. So, you know, it's Poland. So unless you're in Poland, and if you are, you are going through a living hell, you're not aware of it. If I'm in Hamburg or Berlin, I'm getting the living what's it bombed out of me by day and by night by the 8th US Air Force and the RAF at night. And it's a totalitarian state. I mean, it's the very definition. So, you know, everybody goes white rose because a couple of students put out, you know, the leaflets, but they're beheaded, you know, and then you think about the Norman Ormer, a brilliant book called The Infiltrators, and it was, you know, again, these artistic movements in Berlin itself, and they are dealt with ruthlessly, and they are hanged and they are beheaded. So it's not a case of saying, oh, but you must have seen something, because you, even if you are, you think you might have an idea, if you mention this to people, you are very likely to be informed on, because we mentioned the SA, they're gone by, you know, literally sort of 2 years after she becomes Hitler's personal secretary. You know, the SA has been absolutely beheaded and butchered.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you have to bear in mind that, you know, that totalitarian control, not only over society, but over the availability of information. So, you know, we have to bear all of that in mind. And I'm not necessarily defending Schroeder's view here, because I do find it slightly surprising that she doesn't say something about, you know, the concentration camps, for example, because the concentration camps were publicized in Germany in a weird way. These concentration camps, make a distinction here between the concentration camps like Dachau outside Munich, like Sachsenhausen outside Berlin. That's a very different animal from, you know, Auschwitz in occupied Poland or Treblinka outside Warsaw, which are essentially death factories, right? So that's where the Holocaust happens. For those that are unlucky enough to be in Sachsenhausen or in Dachau, you know, it's a pretty bloody horrible place. You know, we're talking a death toll of about 30,000 or 40,000 over the years of their existence each, you know, and numerous other camps. But they don't compare to somewhere like Treblinka, which has a death toll of, you know, something like 800,000, because there's nothing else going on there except death.
Yeah.
They're just industrially killing people. That is top secret. Sachsenhausen and Dachau is not top secret.
Because they're putting political prisoners in, aren't they? They're political prisoners and they're coming out again. And, you know,
part of the sort of threat of Dachau, the political purpose of Dachau, is to intimidate your political enemies. And so that's where you'll end up. Don't do that, right? So that it's actually publicized, certainly before the war, it's publicized. So the fact that she doesn't say anything about those camps and that aspect of the regime, I do find surprising. The bit about the Holocaust, less so, for the reasons I've said. I'm willing, I suppose, maybe more than some, but I'm willing to get it, to some extent, give her the benefit of the doubt on that.
During the end game, we talk about, you know, these people being sort of superstars, but as the end comes, it's very much rats in the sack, isn't it? It's people trying to get out and cut, you know, we have Nazi officials again grabbing political prisoners, grabbing Jews to say, no, it's okay, I'm with this lot, I'm looking after this lot, and they're all fighting for themselves. It's a really weird situation. And, you know, she is there, she sees, you know, Goering, everybody goes about Hitler's use of whatever he can get his hands on. Goering has gone completely crazy and is wearing absolutely out, you know, is ballooned to a huge site, wearing outlandish uniforms and, you know, and sticking whatever he can into his system. It is garish in the extreme to see these personalities sort of break down, if you will. And to have an eyewitness account must be fascinating, Roger.
Yeah, so the end of the war in her book is really interesting. So she was at Berchtesgaden at the end, and then she came back to Berlin with the rest of the entourage, and she watches this spiraling into sort of chaos. You know, she was supposed to be evacuated. I mean, Hitler wanted to get her out, as he did with the rest of the entourage. And then, of course, you know, the Soviet sort of armies close the jaws around Berlin, and she can't get out. So, but her observations of that period are really interesting. And she talks about, you know, the end, the last conversation she had with Hitler was on the phone. And she talks about his voice sort of tailing off into a sort of a muffled murmur sort of thing. And considering, I suppose, that his voice must have been, it's a bit, as we know, it's a big part of his sort of personality to the German people at this time, is his voice. You can see that in, you know, when the Valkyrie plot unraveled in 1944, one of the key moments is when he speaks to an SS officer on the phone, and he says, you know, you can hear my voice, you know who I am, you know I'm alive. And that moment is electric, and that's almost the moment when the plot all falls down, because they know they haven't killed him. So his voice is, you know, is such a central thing to his identity and to his power. And yet she says at the end, you know, his voice was reduced to this sort of muffled murmuring. So it's a really sort of symbolic moment at the end. But it's that view throughout that is so fascinating. And it's where she has these vignettes of these senior Nazis. And you said about Goering, you talked about him at the end as sort of bloated character in these garish, you know, uniforms and sort of
white boots, etc.
He often used to wear rouge, for example, as well, and had these, you know, highly polished red boots. And I mean, just really, and was, you know, was basically off his face on morphine for much of this period, as we well know. So, you know, her descriptions of, you know, people like that from close up is what makes the book fascinating. And that's what I think gives it its historical value, because it's a close up, you know, almost worm's eye view of that sort of, you know, the inside workings of the Third Reich and the characters involved.
How does she did she end up? I mean, she was taken by the Soviets. I mean, you got to think, I mean, without doing a spoiler alert, I mean, she did she serve? Was she imprisoned, or was she so again, is it that where you were just working, you were just a secretary sort of thing?
She got west, so she's one of those that got west. I mean, a few of them managed to get out in that sort of in the chaos, and she got west. She was arraigned for trial and was tried as an accomplice and as a sort of accessory to all of this, and was actually acquitted. So, you know, she by 48 she's clear of all of that and is getting on with her life. And this is when Albert Suller, this French officer, comes back to her and says, oh, but, you know, tell me all about what you did for those 12 years. And that's where, you know, in a sense, her history sort of catches up with her. So she got away pretty scot-free. It wouldn't have been anywhere near so easy if she'd gone the other way and been taken by the Soviets.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I'm going to commit the cardinal sin here, because as you can tell, Roger, I quite like talking about this stuff, but unfortunately we're about to crash the international news. The book is called 12 Years with Hitler, Secretary of the Führer. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. You'll see this fascinating picture of Hitler and the Fraulein herself. If people want to follow you, Roger, where's the best place to find you on social media or the website?
Probably Twitter, I would say. So @Roger_Morehouse. And I'm there with all of my own work and lots of inane comment on contemporary politics as well.
Well, I urge in which case for our listeners to go forth and follow Roger Morehouse. Roger, we're going to run out of time, but it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thanks, Charles.